Accession number 30419, reel 5.
And I can remember my first economics lesson in this Nissen hut, out in the rain and the outskirts of Cranwell Camp, with a squadron leader in the burrow, wonderful guy, and he had this enormous retriever what's the one that looks like a retriever? Labrador. He had a big Labrador, black Labrador, that would walk underneath my legs and stand up. So thus I was perched on this Labrador. Whether this was some kind of initiative inculcation training by squadron leader in the barrow, I don't know, but trying to maintain concentration on laws of demands and supply, laws of demand and supply. But it was fun. It was interesting, and as you said, it fed me brain.
And what were the military studies? What did that involve?
Military studies was very interesting. We had an American army officer, a lieutenant commander from the Royal Navy, and a wing commander who taught us military studies about the history of the Air Force, the Navy, and the Army. That was quite helpful because we had to learn all the equivalent ranks in the other services. That was one of the things we had to do. And we studied the history of war from Roman times through Napoleonic times and onwards, all the ways of fortifications, all about Vauban forts and Martello towers. We had to learn in detail the First World War and the Second World War and all the principles of war. And I remember it was very interesting, except for some of these turgid American textbooks on the whole subjects. And the Americans seem to love to write textbooks about war. And the American style of writing of history, I find, very sleep-making, very soporific. And we had to write projects. I can remember at quite an early stage writing a diatribe against the independent nuclear deterrence, and about the whole principle of nuclear deterrence, which was probably quite a risky thing to do, but because I did it as part of a course, I got away with it. But I felt very strongly about the wrongness of nuclear deterrence. I actually went on a march before I went to Cranwell, and I remember writing that, but it got good marks. So there we are. I wrote another one, and I've had to, always writing things about what it was like. I became quite obsessed with the idea that you could be in a ship like the Hood or the Renown or the Rodney and be blown up and sunk within a minute and a half. So I did a whole piece on what it was like to be in a capital ship in the First World War. Must have been absolutely ghastly, Cathy. Yeah. And what it was like to be in the trenches. Again, unimaginable terror of going over the top.
It was about getting you to live, breathe, sleep it, and really understand it and put yourself in that position.
That's what I wanted to do. The others didn't, and again, I had too much imagination, but maybe. But that's what I did. That was military studies. The French was run by a very effeminate young man. I remember his salute looked more like something that out of Monty Python than anything else. But he got on with it, and we did French. We did Lamartine and Racine and all those books, and as well as spoken French. But one thing we did do was military French, and we had a liaison with the École de l'Air in France, which was very helpful. We went and visited the École de l'Air. They came and visited us, and I could still know a lot of the French terms for squadron and elevator and all that kind of thing. Don't test me. And we took I took the linguist exam, the government's linguist exam, which has come in quite helpful since. And the economics, I passed. Short story short, I got a degree. BA, pass, general studies, London University. But it was a degree. And there were only three of us who did it. And I can remember that moment when called to the commandant's office, no less, to be told. Myself, Tony Ross and Bob O'Brien, we all passed this degree. The four of the others didn't, which was very demoralising for them. And on the AFRES side, I think just three passed again, maybe a few more.
What did that involve?
That involved mathematics, calculus. We did calculus. I did calculus, good Lord. But they had to do advanced mathematics and aerodynamics, heat engineering and aviation-related science topics. It's quite a study for them. And some of those passed. And everybody was very, very pleased, but it didn't last. But it may have been the catalyst that turned the whole thing round so that before very long, you had to have a degree before you could join the Air Force. And a lot of them sponsored at university by this course. But it was far too much to do in 3 years. It nearly killed us. And it knocked the social life. I can remember that in that last term, I got holed up in my room and studying for the degree as well as trying to learn to fly.
Yes, so let me make sure so I've got it. So first term, basic stuff.
Yeah.
So throughout the 3 years, you've got the sort of academic vein running on
yes.
the inside. And I interrupted you. You were about to talk about Christmas in
59. Ah, well, yes. I went home in this similar state of shock, exhausted. Let my hair grow for 2 weeks and was a zombie, really, a social zombie. I fell out with my girlfriend, gave me up for lost. I don't blame her. I mean, I was never there. I was in Lincolnshire, where there were no girls, by the way. We were out in the sticks. So I was institutionalised.
What did your mother?
I can remember the main thing I remember was I was always broke. I couldn't exist on the pay that we had. I think probably because I drank and smoked. Everybody smoked. When we used to go to Dartmouth to play hockey in the winter and cricket in the summer, Dartmouth Naval College, and they gave us a wonderful round tin of 50 players, full strength, naval cut. Gave them to us. And so I drank and smoked too much. I think it was and she was worried about that. And she was also concerned that she had to give me money. She had no money herself, and I ran out of money.
What was she doing at this point?
She was still teaching. And my brother was by this time he was an apprentice at Vickers Armstrong, so he was earning some money. But I did spend too much and couldn't make ends meet, and that worried her, quite rightly so. That's what I remember. I can't think. By this time she wasn't very well. She had contracted cancer. I didn't know it at the time, but she was on the downhill slope. And increasingly, as we got through the course, and I'd gone away, which wasn't very helpful. So I went back to Cranwell for the next term, there were two entries a year. So after one term in those Southbrick lines, we moved up into the junior mess, which was a step up. We got a batman, who looked after us much more. And we started this navigation training and a bit of air experience flying. The navigation training was in the Valletta, which is an old tub of an aeroplane, two engines, two piston engines. We were constantly airsick. We flew around at 5,000 feet or thereabouts, right through all the clouds. And we had to do navigation, practical navigation. The navigation instructor, we were convinced, was a homosexual. Poor man. He probably wasn't, but of course he had to be thrown into close contact with a lot of young men, some of whom were very pretty, in an aeroplane and
in a tight situation.
I'm not sure. I mean, he never approached me, but one or two of the others probably thought he did. Anyway, he taught us navigation, which was interesting in that it had techniques about it. You knew where you were in navigation. You had to get from A to B, and there were techniques for doing it. I found it very rewarding, rather like doing a crossword, working out a crossword, same sort of mental exercise. But when you're being airsick, it's a bit difficult to concentrate. So we hated it. And we would fly for hours, Cathy, in these things, you know, three-hour navigation exercise.
And what are you looking for when you're navigating?
Well, first of all, you had to plot the course on a chart, and you had to know what the wind is, and you have to work out drift. And for that, we used a Dalton computer. I've still got a little one up there. It's a sliding plastic effort that goes through a roundel, and on the roundel you set your drift, and you slide the plastic effort to your airspeed, and you can work out what your drift should be. Then you have to do map reading, so you take a note of the points on the ground and work out your actual drift, and then you can calculate what your change of course is to make good track. That's called dead reckoning. You supplement that with radio direction finding, which can give you three radio fixes, and you plot those, and you've got three, and you've got a little thing called a cocked hat, and you reckon you're in the middle of that cocked hat. That's navigation. And we used to go all over the bloody sky. We used to get lost. But the pilot always knew where we were, fortunately. But he, of course, had to obey our instructions as to which way to fly. But fortunately, he kept his own check. It was good, and that was what we did. All of us, whether you were going to become a navigator or an equipment officer an equipment officer, we had equipment and secretarial, and maybe they didn't do the navigation training, but the pilots and the navigators did. And then the air experience flight was on a chipmunk. I can remember taking off in the morning of Princess Anne's wedding and landing after she was married. We had to take off because there was some kind of block on takeoffs and landings during the wedding. So we had to take off before it and land after it. I was sick for hours. This ruddy chipmunk over Lincolnshire really was quite in danger of putting me off flying.
It was that bad?
Yeah, it was awful. And then the Easter of 1960, we went on survival camp in the Cairngorms, but right, I've just found out that we didn't start flying at Cranwell until January 1961. By the centre, we were, and I only did two flights in those navigation trainers, one in a Valletta and one in a Varsity, and three flights in the Chipmunk. There we are. But that doesn't matter. Is that the right level?
Yes.
Yes. Well, in 1960, we were still the lowest of the low, really. We had done some navigation training and some air experience flying, but we were not going to fly on basic training until the beginning of the next year, January 1961. So that meant that we came there in September 59, and we had the whole of 1960 without any flying training. Now that surprises me. I'd forgotten that we were so long in basic training, drill, and humanities subjects, science subjects, navigation subjects, everything that the RAF regiment did with us for warfare studies, that kind of thing. But so it was a long time before we were going to fly, and already we'd lost quite a number of colleagues. When we arrived, we were about 18 people in our little squadron, so there were about 56 on the whole entry. The first night we arrived, we lost a fella because he had to sign a form saying he wasn't married, but he was married. So he went the next morning. He was an ex-apprentice, I think, and he happily got married and didn't realise he couldn't go to Cramwell when he was married, and the authorities didn't realise he was married. There we are, there's one. Another guy got a very bad leg. I forget how he got it, but he had to go down an entry whilst that recovered. And we lost another two guys during 1960. One was the son of a senior ranking Air Force officer, and he just hated the whole idea of going in the Air Force, and obviously he'd been forced in by his family and circumstances and so forth. And another fellow, old Finn Featherstone Hoare, who gave the drill instructor such entertainment, he and this other guy left, and I can remember them driving round the Orange, which was the big grass area in front of the college, in an old Riley in a triumphant farewell. And then we had others who dropped out after survival camp, and at Easter 1960 we were sent up to the Grampian Mountains, the whole entry, and there we spent, I think it was 10 days. It felt like much longer than that, but from my recollection we did about a week in a fixed camp in the Grampians, somewhere near the ski centre, where we were divided into teams of about six or seven and had to set up various shelters, various exercises. We did three 3,000-foot peaks in a day, for example, in full kit but only survival packs, nothing heavy. That was fairly energetic. We did escape and evasion techniques. We did cooking, and the cooking was quite interesting because we had nothing. We just had sort of what they call them, iron rations, I think that's what it's called, a little pack of self-heating soup, that kind of stuff. Self-heating soup, yes. I never worked out how that worked, but it was some kind of chemical reaction which made the thing warm. It was awful. We had to boil all the water. We weren't allowed fresh water. We had to put water purification tablets into the brackish water the instructors could find, and that was awful. And we cooked what we could find, And I can remember a very tasty meal of fir cone soup, for example. We've been told that there was enough in a fir cone, if you boiled it in water, to give you at least some sustenance. Cathy, it's awful. it tastes like it sounds, fir cones boiled in water. Yes, yes. We didn't catch any squirrels or any small animals. They were far too canny to come near us. So that was fairly interesting. And then on the last day in camp, we had to do a cooking competition. So we had to, the senior officer would come along and test what we'd cooked. And the on my detail, there was one rather fastidious guy who didn't get really involved in too much of the dirty stuff if he could avoid it, and we chose him as the waiter because he had the cleanest hands. He later became an Air Vice Marshal. And the cooking competition was the highlight. The shelters were various. We had a big shelter for us all to sleep in, and then we went down to A-frames, which are single-man shelters in a hollow in the ground somewhere, and we spent the night in those. Anything we could find, branches, parachute silk, and parachute webbing lines. So it was whatever we would have bailed out in, we had to build the shelters with. We had a nice strong knife because we carried that was carried as a part of an aircrew kit. But it was, the shelters were not, they wouldn't have passed any building regulations tests, and it was all very interesting, quite exhausting. And then at the end of that, we were put into 3-ton trucks at night with the sides all down, so we couldn't see where we were going, and we were driven off into the Grampian Mountains. I don't know whether they still do it. They probably do outward bound, and that, but there'll be all kinds of safety procedures. We were just dropped in the middle of nowhere and told to find our way back to a rendezvous. We had a map, aviation type map, I suppose, and we didn't know where we were. There were, let me see, three of us, I think. They were dropped in groups of three, and in my group, I can't remember who was in my group. Oh yes, I can. In my group was the guy who was the son of the senior officer, and he hadn't left yet. And I think this was part of the downward slope. He was extraordinarily bolshy and didn't want to do any of it. The other guy was a small, rugged Scotsman. That's right, Nigel Bing, who was a survivor, if ever there was one. And the idea was that we would get back to this rendezvous, which was a map reference, and we would... And on the way, we'd be hunted by the RAF regiment, the Rock Apes, as we called them, and they were trying to capture us. And if they captured us, they would put us through the interrogation techniques that they had practiced. So this was what was to happen. Well, I can remember we couldn't find out where we were. There were no signposts. It was right out in the middle of the Grampians. There was a bridge and a stream, but there are quite a few bridges and streams in the Grampians. It was at night, so it was quite difficult to read the map. And anyway, we set off in the direction we thought we were supposed to be going in, all fairly sullen, really, middle of the night, pretty hungry. And long story short, we got completely lost. It started to snow. We were on the side of a mountain at Easter in the Grampians in the snow, and of course we all know you're not supposed to lie down and go to sleep in snow because you might not get up again, But we did, because we just dropped exhausted. We'd been walking so long, and of course we hadn't eaten very well for a week. So we were beginning to feel that this really was a survival camp. It was for real. We never found out where we were until we finally stumbled after two nights back on the camp we started from, which was really just good fortune. We really had no idea where we were for all this time. But of course we'd arrived back early, so we were put into a Land Rover and taken out again and dropped again and told to get to that rendezvous. Very difficult. It now started to rain. I remember one wonderful night in a barn where the farmer's wife brought us oat cakes and hot mugs of cocoa. I mean, that was the highlight of the whole survival camp. We never found the rendezvous. We never got captured. We were picked up in the pouring rain by a Land Rover and taken back to camp in the end. And I suppose that we survived, but we didn't exactly cover ourselves in glory. Some people did find the rendezvous, and others got captured and told us of stories of the interrogation techniques, which were pretty rough. Nothing life-threatening, but demeaning. Well, stripped naked and put up against a wall and a wet bag put over your head and that sort of thing. And interrogation, shouted interrogations, and all you were supposed to give was your name, rank and number. And I think had that happened to me, I don't think I would have behaved myself terribly well, but I was never tested. But a lot of the others were. And not many people made the rendezvous because it was quite difficult to do. And then I suppose we were then all cleaned up, taken to Inverness railway station, and I woke up in London, at Grantham. I woke up at Grantham. We got on the train, and I slept all the way to Grantham. So exhausted. Got back to college, went on leave. So that was the highlight of that term. Then through the summer, the leaves were marvellous when you're at Cranwell. 3-year course. The first half of it dedicated to knocking you down as low as they could so that they could then build you up into what they wanted. So when you went on leave, you felt liberated beyond imagination, and you went back to your girlfriend. I mean, your girlfriend wasn't very interested in me because I was so beaten up, really, and didn't have much spark or energy. I did play cricket, and I worked on the buildings. I remember that, to get a bit of money, and that was quite good because it put you back into a world which was as far from Cranwell as it could possibly be, with Irish navvies and rough, tough labourers, all who went down to the pub at night and had razor fights and that kind of thing. Extraordinary. So you couldn't stand on your dignity in that environment. So that was quite a good contrast. Can't remember what happened in the autumn of that year, but there were three times a year there were competitions. There was a drill competition which was, I think, called the Ferris Cup, which our squadron, C Squadron, was quite good at because we had the best of all the drill instructors. That was quite fun. I liked that. I liked drill and parades. I found that they were, it was like country dancing, really.
Maybe.
Well, the music and the pomp and circumstance and the anonymity of being one of hundreds of people all doing the same thing under instruction. You had no responsibility except to follow the instructions, and that was, I suppose, what drill is designed for, to train people to go into battle and